want to take a ride. Boy, I'll tell you what. Congratulations, Bob Bigelow. What a story. He's got his own spacecraft in orbit. One man, with a big staff, of course, but one man dedicated with the money, the resources, the will to do what he did. It's just an astounding story. Hi, everybody. I'm Art Bell, coming to you from the other side of the globe. If you doubt that, get it out. Take a look. It is indeed the other side, about 7,700-some-odd miles from my previous home, and one I still maintain, I might add, in the high desert. Coming up in a moment, Sir Charles Schulz, we're going to be talking about nanotechnology, which happens to be one of my favorite topics. Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta, the aerospace company, of course, for 10 years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote, get this, he wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing 2 missile system, worked on Patriot, the Copperhead tank killer, and advanced attack helicopter systems. Charles has performed research under grants on nuclear fusion, was knighted, and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence. He has written many technical publications and magazine articles on space. Coming up in just a moment, Sir Charles Schulz III. All right, definitely one of my favorite topics in all the world. Sir Charles Schulz III, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Art. It's always a pleasure.
It's great to have you here. And I suppose we need to begin, of course, we've talked a great deal about Mars, and you've had an awful lot of information on Mars. And I know you've got a little more, and we'll get on to that. But let's begin at the beginning. A lot of people have really no idea what nanotechnology is. This is a fairly well-educated audience, to be sure, in this kind of thing. But nevertheless, a 101 on nanotechnology would be a great way to begin. What is it?
Well, basically, it's the ability to manipulate things at the level of the atom. Now, nanotechnology takes its name from the scale, and a nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. So anything as small as a nanometer or a few nanometers of scale would be considered nanotechnology if you were to manipulate the parts at that scale.
Uh-huh. Toward what ends, Sir Charles?
The ability to construct anything from atoms all the way up. For instance, we could construct new materials that have never existed before. We could do repairs on things that are too small to even handle. We could learn so much just from the ability to manipulate the atom individually, just as a building block. And this is the basis of nanotechnology.
Okay. When you say small, give everybody an idea of how small you really mean. When you say atoms, you build sort of atoms into, if my understanding is correct, into kind of a machine, and possibly even a self-replicating machine. Is that fair?
Well, yes, that's one of the places it's going. To give you an example, if you had 10 atoms in a row, that would be about 1 nanometer, 1/1,000,000th of a meter. So an atom is an extremely tiny thing. A red blood cell, for instance, is just under 10 microns or 10,000 nanometers in size. So these things are much smaller than a red blood cell, and many of the nano devices that we will be constructing in the near term will probably be on the order of scale of a virus, very, very tiny indeed.
A virus. Is this something that you can readily see with an appropriate microscope or what?
Well, unfortunately, no. Most of the devices we're talking about would be so tiny they could only be seen with special hardware, such as a scanning electron microscope or something called an atomic force microscope. Devices of this type can allow us to see individual atoms as they're assembled in things, and they look very much like Legos or building blocks when they go together to form structures. And most of the structures we'll be putting together in the beginning will be modified enzymes and protein structures and chemicals for very specific tasks. But unbelievably, small particles of metal have figured very highly in the earliest nanotechnology, and I'll get to the details on that very shortly.
Okay. I can't even imagine how you would begin. You can barely see something like this with a scanning electron microscope, as you point out. So how in God's name would you manipulate something like that?
Well, the very first nano manipulation could arguably be called chemistry. But, of course, that's done on a very large bulk scale, so we don't really have a fine control over it. The first manipulation of atoms that was really done intentionally was done by IBM using something called a scanning tunneling microscope. And in this type of device, they have an extremely tiny needle that is made of a fractured piece of diamond. And on its tip, they change an electric charge, and it allows them to pick up and drop simple tiny atoms or tiny bits of a protein or a chemical. And they were able to use atoms to arrange as dots or pixels to write the letters IBM on a piece of chilled metal.
I recall that, yes. So that was the beginning. And the future is... I'll tell you what. I think scientists, Sir Charles, rarely talk to each other, because I have some very reputable scientists who are on the show, and I ask them about whether nanotechnology has some bearing, for example, on what they're doing. And they seem to know very little or almost nothing about it. And so I worry whether scientists in this country and other countries are actually talking to each other about what may be possible and how it may bear on their science.
Well, unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of communication, because when you're doing research of this type, it can be very intellectually exhausting to have to concentrate on the details. And as a result, because of the difficulties, they tend to congregate among themselves in small groups, two, three, or four people, and yes, focus on specific, you know, parts of the technology. So there's very little communication sometimes between these groups, because nobody wants to give away their secrets as they're working.
Yeah.
Fortunately, there's a great deal of information being exchanged by an unlikely source, and it's scientists who become science fiction writers. And they share ideas with each other, and they spread them around so the public gets a taste of what's going on. And in many cases, these ideas feed right back into the development of nanotechnology. So it's an odd thing that science fiction actually becomes a driving force in scientific development in many cases.
So a lot of scientists would be well-served to be reading science fiction.
Well, this is true. I'll give you an example. Many people are familiar with a science fiction author by the name of Larry Niven. And one of the gadgets that he came up with in his future history stories that he writes is something called an impact armor. And essentially, it's a garment that looks very much like any other, but anytime it's struck by a projectile over a certain speed, it hardens. So it protects the wearer from damage, just like a bulletproof vest. Recent developments in nanotechnology were made in, of all places, in the field of a lubricant. They were converting molecules into tiny nanoparticles to make a lubricant out of them. And they discovered that when they suspended this lubricant and some Kevlar and tiny particles of glass or ceramic, it became a type of impact armor, so that when something strikes it, the material, which is generally a liquid, becomes hard, and it becomes five times stronger than steel. So you have a garment now that they're developing that weighs about as much as a thick T-shirt, and it has the ability to stop bullets. And to give you an example of the hardness of this material, they found that it can take an impact of up to 250 tons per square centimeter. That's like dropping four diesel locomotives in an area the size of your fingernail.
My God. Now, wait a minute. Back up. You said this thing is about the thickness of a thick T-shirt, and it would resist a bullet?
That's correct. Because the material,
and this exists right now.
They're working on it right now. What's happening is it was an Israeli company called AppNano, and they found that when they were working on their lubricant, by suspending these particles in the lubricant, when you strike it, the particles stick together in clusters and make the lubricant become a solid momentarily. So it's an unusual material that becomes stiff when you apply a force to it, and then becomes liquid again when you remove the force.
Okay. What I can't grasp in my mind is how this material, we're talking about a speeding bullet here, and obviously the nanomaterial cannot decide that it's being impacted by something until it's actually impacted. So the decision made by the nanomaterial has to be more than just instantaneous. I mean, it has to be virtually instant, right?
Well, the key is the fact the particles are so tiny that the reaction times of the particles can be down on the billionths of a second. So it's in the nanosecond range. So we're down to the nano in both scales, size and time. The material itself is made of some fairly common materials. They were originally using fullerenes, the buckyballs that everybody's heard about. Mm-hmm. But they turned out to be a little more difficult to work with than they expected, and they moved to a material called tungsten disulfide. And so now they have this liquid that, when struck by a bullet, dissipates the force over its entire surface by rendering the whole surface solid. Now, this is in contrast to Kevlar. Kevlar can pretty much stop bullets, but not a steel bullet or, you know, an armor-piercing bullet. This
right.
material actually dissipates the force over a very large area, and Kevlar doesn't technically isn't capable of doing that very well.
Well, no. If you now, I've never been hit by a bullet wearing Kevlar, but it still knocks you back and disables you for a while, I'm sure, if what I see on television is halfway accurate, and that's the only place I've really seen it. People look like, you know, they've been shot, and they act like they've been shot, and then finally, of course, they get up and they're alive. This material that you're talking about would dissipate the impact over a larger area, so there would not be as much of a force applied, or would there be, to the person on the receiving end?
That's right. It spreads the trauma out over a much larger area. You don't end up with as much force concentrated in a tiny area. So instead of being alive with a huge number of bruises on your chest,
right.
you'll end up with a much larger spread out impact. It'll still knock you down, of course, but yes, it won't hurt you.
That's absolutely amazing. And how far are we from this being something that, you know, a police officer or somebody in the military can go and buy and use?
Well, let's see. They're scaling up the production of their materials right now so that they can go into mass production. They can only make a few kilograms of the material a day right now with the existing facilities, but they're installing new hardware in their laboratories so we can scale up to full production. And they've also found new materials that stand up to 350 tons per square centimeter, and they found even lighter materials that should be even four times lighter than this. So pretty soon we could expect to see literally bulletproof T-shirts.
Bulletproof T-shirts. What an amazing time we truly live in. And then that's only the beginning of nanotech. Nanotech, if it lives up to its promise, Sir Charles, it will utterly transform the world we're in, won't it?
Well, it certainly will. And what I see mostly is everything we've looked at so far looks like the very beneficial side of it. And we definitely want to cover the beneficial side. But I also want to point out, as we had discussed previously, that there is also a dark side to some of this. And so we'll get around to how some of these things could also be misused as well. And it's not to alarm people, but it's to let people know that for everything we do, there's always the potential for misuse. And so this will allow people to be sort of on their guard.
Well, there is an announcement running on Manila television today, which is sort of a bounce from what happened in the Middle East. But as of today, we are not allowed to carry any kind of liquid, including water, on any form of mass transit here in Manila. Now, this is happening around the world, I suppose. And that's liquid. Whatever. You creams, all the rest of it, you can't take on aircraft anymore. I just can't even begin to imagine, Sir Charles, what kind of world we're going to have when somebody has a nanotech weapon in their possession. For one thing, it would not be seen, would it?
Well, for the most part, no, it wouldn't. On the positive side now, they do have new detectors that also use nanotechnology that might be able to find some of those things. But a nanotech weapon could be hidden very effectively and be extremely difficult to locate. So we would have to probably turn to newer technologies to try and design systems that could locate and disarm those things. And it could be extremely difficult because there are methods of producing materials using nanotechnology that are presently under investigation where you could take raw materials and convert them to a finished product in a matter of seconds or minutes, and the raw materials themselves might be harmless. Fortunately, right now, we're up against the limit of energy. You can't make an explosive out of something without a source of energy.
Right.
So it would probably be something other than an explosive, a toxin or something that could eat metal. And, you know, you could actually literally make a metal-eating virus-type machine out of nanotechnology.
Great. There is a pretty gigantic downside to the development of this technology, isn't there? I mean,
well,
being
there
honest
is.
Here. Yeah.
Sure.
I've heard about the gray goo. I've heard about some of the other possibilities. Do you want to go ahead and explain to everybody what gray goo is? Might as well scare the hell out of them right away.
Okay, sure I will. There was a fellow by the name of K. Eric Drexler who wrote one of the seminal books on nanotechnology, and one of the things that he warned about was called the gray goo syndrome. Nanotechnology would depend on tiny machines that effectively could take things apart, make new things out of them, and you could also program those machines to make copies of themselves. If you made nano disassemblers that ate everything around them and turned it into more nano disassemblers, you would have a self-propagating system that would eat everything in its path and convert it into more nano. And eventually you'd have, if the stuff ran amok, you could turn everything into this gray goo, and it would just consume everything. On the upside, the energetics of it and the supplies of the proper materials to build more assemblers or disassemblers might be the limiting factor. You know, there's the argument that, well, viruses and germs can replicate like mad and they haven't consumed the world. But one of the advantages that nanotechnology would have is it might not use organic materials. It might use the dirt itself.
Exactly. That was my concern. You can construct a virus that'll be terribly lethal, but one of the things, of course, that has stopped these lethal viruses, like Ebola, for example, is the fact that once it gets loose, it kills all of its hosts too quickly, and then it's got nowhere else to jump, nowhere else to go. And so it's been small brush fires, typically in Africa, and it'll kill a village or two and then burn out, kind of like a brush fire. In the case of a nanotechnological weapon of the sort you just talked about, if it could convert dirt or metal or plastic or anything else into other disassemblers, there is nothing that would stop it.
That's right. It could eat everything. And, you know, one of the advantages with biological weapons is that most of them are quite fragile. They don't exist well in the real world, and so
That's
when
right.
they're exposed to air and dry conditions, they tend to insist or die.
Right.
And so in the end, they're self-limiting in many respects. I mean, otherwise, there'd be no carriers for them, and they'd kill themselves out. So nature somehow has built a limiting factor into many germs. With nanotechnology, they're effectively like little robots, and they can lie dormant for incredible periods of time.
Sir Charles, who is doing most of the nano work right now? Is it mainly in the private sector? Is it in little labs? Is the government doing it? Are there controls over it? Where are
there
we?
There is some going on in the private sector, mostly for specific materials like carbon nanofibers for high tensile strength materials. Most of the research that I've come across has been done in laboratories and universities, and a great deal of it is government-funded. So I would say that, by and large, most of the research is being done in universities under government funding.
Under government funding?
That's correct.
Do you know offhand who is doing most of the funding within the government? What kind of agency?
Well, it really depends on the application. Some is being done under Department of Defense grants. Particularly, defense is interested in finding explosives. For instance, there's a group in Israel that has come up with something they call the nanodog. And this device is capable of sniffing out explosives at the one part per trillion level, and they're looking at a version that could be pocket-sized. So this actually would lighten up our restrictions on air travel because you'd be able to detect most explosives very easily with a pocket-sized device. On the other hand, in this country particularly, in the United States, a lot of it is basically new materials such as the liquid armor stuff, materials that are capable of carrying drugs into a cell, which is being done mostly under grant from medical companies. But a lot of it comes down to devices for detecting explosives or devices for carrying information, devices for storing information, new computer devices. Some of it's by electronics. By and large, a lot of it's material science at this point, because we're really very, very early in the game.
Okay, well, IBM spelled out IBM. Now, since that time, I wonder if IBM has proceeded in the world of nanotechnology. I know they're kind of up against some law or another that suggests eventually the chips that are being made to power the computers that we so greedily snap up, we're going to run into a brick wall eventually. And nanotechnology, I guess, promises much faster processors, right?
Well, that's right, yes. The law you refer to is called Moore's Law, and basically it states that every 18 months we tend to double the amount of processing power we have available. And that's held very well over the last few decades, and it's amazing how well the law has held up. So every 18 months we expect that things are going to double in speed. Nanotechnology has allowed us to do some research in materials that have produced single-atom transistors, for instance.
Oh, my God. Hey, listen, hold on, Sir Charles. We're here at the bottom of the hour from Manila in the Philippines. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back. Manila, where the rain is coming down just about sideways. We're currently experiencing Tropical Storm Katring, K-A-T-R-I-N-G. They name tropical storms here and typhoons a little differently than they do in the States, and I've yet to figure that one out. It seems like a name ought to be a name, but they do that. My guest is Sir Charles Schulz III. We're talking about nanotechnology, and we just touched on Moore's Law. Now, Moore's Law really does suggest that every 18 months we will double our computer speeds. Now, it's just me, or maybe I haven't been out looking at new computers sufficiently, but I don't think that we've been holding up to that lately. Seems to me that we got to the 3.5 gigahertz computer, and we kind of slowed down at about that point. I'll ask Sir Charles about that in a moment. Well, all right. Once again, Sir Charles Schulz III. Sir Charles, you know, I'm not so sure about Moore's Law. Moore's Law, certainly, I watched it go along quite readily for a lot of years. It seems to me in the last 2 or perhaps 3 years, I'm not sure that I've really seen the kind of doubling that we had previously. Do you know anything about that?
Well, yes. Some of the fastest chips right now are a little over 4 gigahertz. But instead of making the chips faster, what they're doing now is putting multiple cores on the chip so right. that, for instance, the cell processor can do 10 instructions simultaneously. So you are still getting more speed, more processing in a unit of time than you were, you know, like 18 months ago. You don't see the clock speed go up because more devices are working simultaneously. But what you do see is an increase in the number of instructions that get performed. But yes, we're getting very close to the limit of what we can do. I mean, even with the cell processor, they can move something like 100 gigabytes of data every second, which is an incredible amount of information.
Yes.
But we do seem to be running up into the limits. And so with nanotechnology, we now are reaching a point where we're going to be using molecular scale devices and atomic scale devices. Now, there's an interesting difference in the way a nanocomputer would work versus a typical microprocessor, and it's very simple. Nanocomputing basically will be a mechanical device, almost like rods and beads. Think of an abacus. But The fact is, the materials are so tiny and can move so rapidly that a processor measuring less than half a micron on a side, a tiny cube, half of a millionth of a meter on a side, could produce a billion instructions per second.
Well, it's nothing. It's still nothing more than a yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, all the way through, right?
Well, that's correct. And some systems have then suggested that would use more than binary, that would use multiple state logic, and they would move faster. But it makes the design far more complicated. So binary seems to be the rule for now and probably will be for quite a long time, yes and no, all the way from top to bottom. But the ability to make them smaller and faster and even, you know, more powerful by putting more in parallel is what we're going to gain. After all, the human brain doesn't use very fast units. They switch in the scale, you know, on the scale of milliseconds, thousands of a second, whereas processors are generally running in the billionths of a second. And yet we don't see processors running around shaking your hand and ordering things on, you know, online and eating lunch with you. And the problem
will we someday is a,
well,
a
we
very
probably
important
will.
Question.
I certainly do expect that we will. And the reason is we're going to be doing things differently, not just switching things on and off, but doing it in a massively parallel fashion. And so nanotechnology gives you the ability to create thousands or millions or billions of processors that work in parallel. And each of them would be very simple, but all together as an aggregate, they could outperform the human brain, certainly.
Okay, Sir Charles. I know that you have your fingers into artificial intelligence, and this is a question I've always wanted to have somebody answer, and I guess there's probably not an answer to it, but as a processor becomes faster and storage becomes cheaper and more abundant, at some point, and I wonder if you would like to make a guess where that point is, isn't a processor a computer, perhaps a nanotechnological computer, going to achieve some kind of consciousness?
Well, that's going to occur due to organization of software and hardware, not just due to the hardware itself. You see, part of what makes us conscious, apparently, is not just how our hardware is arranged, but a lot of what we learn and how we experience things. We have an internal theater in our minds that allows us a picture of reality. And right. That theater is a piece of hardware, but it's got a lot of software running in it, too. And how you learn to perceive things changes how you think. We're going to have to really put a great deal of work into the discipline of software in order to make the hardware reach a state where we could call it conscious.
Do you think we ought to do that?
Well, you know, that's like saying, should we invent fire? It's going to be an inevitable thing. It's going to happen whether we should or not. My feeling is we could benefit from having another set of minds to consult on many problems. But the question is, what are we going to do with them other than that? So it's got an upside and a downside. There literally is a case where you could argue that an intelligent machine society could decide to take over the world for our own benefit.
That's right. That's the exact argument. And, you know, if you look around the world right now, and there were, if we were in possession of such a machine, and it had the ability to project force in some manner, it might well decide that for our own benefit, it would project force, for example, to the Middle East and simply eradicate everything that's going on over there right now for our own benefit, so it wouldn't lead to World War III and the end of the human race.
And that's a distinct possibility. It's very hard to say exactly where it will lead, because we can't even predict what a group of human beings will do. Now you talk about a system that is as intelligent or better in terms of functionality than a human being, and you get a group of them together, what are they going to do? We can't predict what a society will do, much less what an intelligent machine would do.
Well, wouldn't we almost have to inculcate into such a machine what we know of the three laws of robotics? I mean, wouldn't that have to be almost first before you allowed such a machine to attain consciousness and decision-making and put power in its hands?
Well, it would, but understand that a machine that's capable of understanding what those laws mean might decide not to follow them. I think that the only safe way to do it is to incorporate some sort of a dead man switch in it, where you literally can deactivate it remotely.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But of course, such a machine would be perhaps so bright that it would have a way around that. I mean, it's a really scary proposition, putting that kind of power in a machine's hands.
Yes, it is. But, you know, it's like many of the things we do. They creep up on us. We accept a little here and a little there, and before you know it, the full-blown problem is sitting in our laps.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of full-blown problems that are potentially attached to nanotechnology. And one of them, for example, would be, I mean, in the medical field, there are endless possibilities, aren't there, for nanotechnology?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There have been some amazing developments in the medical fields in nanotechnology. One of the things that they found is that, for instance, we were talking about AI and medical applications and nanotechnology. They can make arrays of nanotubes. They're like little dots on a substrate, and they can put neurons on the substrate, and they grow essentially an artificial brain, and the spacings between the cells are just right for them to reach to each other and form the synapses and connections that they need. Another thing they can do now is they have found ways of using the flagella, the little moving parts that stick out of tiny bacteria or cells, and use them to move things around. And in that, in the developments that they've come up with, they've found ways to make devices that can carry drugs directly into tumor cells and kill them. They found out how to work on Alzheimer's using particles of gold that are only a few atoms across. I think this is one of the more interesting ones. By making nanoparticles of gold metal, they have infused them into brain tissue, and they form gatherings where the clumps of Alzheimer's plaques are. And then by exposing them to low-level radio waves, about half or a fifth of the energy in a cell phone, over the course of a few hours, the plaques break up and die. And so they've actually found a way to treat the plaques in Alzheimer's patients by using gold nanoparticles.
Well, that's amazing. And they've actually done this?
Yes, they have. Most of the work was done on the University of Chile in Santiago by Marcelo Kogan. The particles, the particles clump with the cells that are degenerating, and on the application of radio waves, they apparently move around and destroy the cells. The particles appear to vibrate or induce heat in the cells and kill them.
Wow, that's simply amazing.
And it's a wonderful thing. But then you can look at the downside. Somebody who was, let's say, interested in destroying things using this sort of technology could tag the particles so that they would attach to crops. And then on command could send a low-level radio signal that would destroy all the crops. Yeah, that would be the downside of that sort of technology.
So, I've also heard that nanotechnology, for example, might be used to construct what would seem to be or would be very much like a virus that, for example, might go out and kill one specific race of people, that it could be that...
The targeted virus scenario, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Making machinery that has some processing power on that scale, you literally could make it go out, identify specific markers in cells, like specific types of traits such as red hair or whatever you can imagine, and kill those people. And a targeted virus is a very real threat, and it's something that you have to know they've got to be working on.
Are they working on it?
I don't have any personal knowledge of research being done in the field, but it is such a tempting thing, you can imagine that a lot of people are looking at it, at least eyeing it and thinking, man, this would be something we could use.
And something probably we would use.
It's hard to imagine a scenario where they wouldn't. If somebody got mad enough, I can think of some terrible things that people have done.
Is all of this technology, Sir Charles, racing ahead too quickly? I mean, our social development is not moving nearly as quickly, obviously, looking at recent world events, as is this kind of technology. Would you agree?
I think that's probably true. Socially, most of humanity seems to have a structure on par with the caveman. And it's hard to say, but most people seem to be just about functional enough to get to the next meal.
Yeah.
And when we are confronted with issues this depth, of this complexity, a lot of times people simply shut down. They turn away and say, I'm not interested, or I don't want to hear about it, or I don't want another thing to worry about. And so the problem is there is no vigilance because people who should know about the things simply shut down and turn away when they hear about it. It's just another big problem for them.
Well, I can understand that attitude. I'm not one of those people, but I can certainly understand it with everything that's going on right now. And people seemingly, I mean, we are a warrior-like people. Human beings are definitely warrior people. And you can prove that on any given day looking around the world. So if there was a little nano kind of virus that would kill a specific people, you know damn well it would be used. And I wonder if there's any way to find out if anybody is working on this. Surely they are, and who it is, and whether, and hopefully we're first on the block. But I worry about these things that perhaps we're not.
Well, I can think of a lot of ways it could be done, and I'm not even going to mention them. I can think of a lot of things that you could do that could be used to tag or locate specific genotypes. But, I'm not even going to go there. And I do expect that somebody would try it. I can only hope that our positive developments will help us along to the point where we're able to circumvent a lot of those problems.
Mm-hmm. I wish that I believed that you're correct. But let's go back to one of the positive applications.
Okay, certainly.
One of the things that everybody would like to see improve is the battery. The ability to store energy. I mean, already our computers, our laptops are getting lighter. The batteries are lasting longer. They've made some strides, but we still don't have a really cool battery. Would nanotech provide one?
Yes, it can. There are two very interesting developments that have happened in energy storage using nanotechnology. One of them came from bacteria that have the ability to consume metals and produce a husk when they die that has metal in it. Researchers were finding that they could make wires using bacteria. The bacteria form what they call nanowires. The bacteria consume metal-containing food. They produce a shell around themselves that is conductive. And then when they die, they make clumps of these wires, tubular structures. Then these structures are electroplated, and they're used as battery electrodes. And the reason this is a positive thing is because it induces a huge amount of surface area in the electrode. And one of the tricks of the battery is the more surface area you have, the more current you can deliver. Mm-hmm. So nanowire electrodes are already being made and experimented with using bacteria to produce them. So that's one of them. The other development is the use of carbon materials to produce an extremely fluffy material similar to an aerogel. It's a material that is mostly empty space made out of carbon, and to use it to make a new type of capacitor. Everybody's seen the supercapacitors, which are getting pretty close to batteries in storage density, and they charge very rapidly. Well, these are a whole new level of capacitive storage. They can be recharged in seconds. A lot of the work is being done at MIT. They have a laboratory for electromagnetic and electronic systems, and they're working out the first real new breakthrough in battery technology in two centuries. And there's a scientist there by the name of Joey Schindel, and he's a professor of electrical engineering and computer science, and he's been working on this for a while with some other people as well, and they've come up with a nanotube structure that makes an ultracapacitor. So when you
a nanotube supercap, right?
That's right, a ultracapacitor, much more dense than the supercapacitor, and it would actually be capable of acting as a battery instead of just a plain capacitor. So we're getting to the point where we'll have very lightweight, very dense storage systems that we've grown on a chip. And those are coming along very, very soon.
Again, other aspects of science seem to be roundly ignoring nanotechnology, or they don't believe that it can live up to the kind of billing that you're giving it here tonight. But, I mean, here you are telling me that we've already got these supercaps. Now, normally a capacitor, the kind of capacitors we have and use in radio and television and electronics, they charge and then they very rapidly discharge, and it's hard to see how there would be an application to use one as a battery except for perhaps an extremely low current application of some sort.
Yeah, most capacitors typically charge and discharge on the order of thousands or millions of a second, and
right.
That's one of the reasons they're very useful in circuits, oscillators, tuned circuits, time delays, that
sure.
sort of thing.
Sure.
But when you get to this new type of capacitance, you're actually looking at something that competes with batteries and possibly even with fuels. So this is a really new development, and it could mean that we could have an electric vehicle that could be recharged in a minute or so and would carry you for a couple of hundred miles on that charge, and the storage system itself could be comparable to 5 or 6 lead-acid batteries in volume, but way far less.
Wow. There's still, I take it, would not be a bottom-line difference in the energy used, even though you could charge it, for example, in a couple of minutes, as you point out.
Well,
the bottom-line energy used would still be what it is today with another, or would the efficiency be so much better that that would not be true?
Well, when you consider you're not lugging around the weight of lead-acid batteries like typical electric vehicles, then your efficiency does improve because you don't have so much dead weight you're hauling around.
Right.
The overall efficiency of your motors is pretty much as it's been. You're going to have AC motors to drive the wheels, and you get pretty good efficiency out of AC motors. Still, when you come right down to it, you still have to consume some fuel somewhere else to charge your batteries up. And I think a lot of people miss this about electric vehicles. When you run an electric vehicle, you may be spending 3 or 4 times as much in energy to go a mile than you do out of an internal combustion engine.
Right.
The only difference is the pollution is over at the power plant and not out of your tailpipe. So
that's
people
right.
don't see it. And there are losses in transmission. When you transmit electrical power from the generator at the power plant, you may get better efficiency generating the electricity, but by the time it's gone through the wires, through the transformers, through the charger, through the battery charge, you know, into the batteries and then back to your wheels, you could have lost so much of it that you're now burning 3 to 4 times as much energy just to get somewhere.
Right. Well, there's also an application, is there not, in the actual distribution of electricity. In other words, right now, the transmission charges you get that are part of your electrical bill are rather substantial. It costs a lot of money to send electricity from point A to point B because there are losses in delivery of electricity through copper or any other metal you can name right now, right?
That's true. You know, there's quite a bit of loss in transmission lines, but there's also the cost of maintaining those lines. And that's something that, you know, that's one of those invisible costs we don't really think about. Somebody's got to go out there and keep those lines repaired and maintained, and it costs quite a bit of money. One of the things that we're looking at with nanotechnology in the new future is the possibility of coming up with some sort of superconductor that works at room temperature. And this is, we're getting into a whole new area here where nanotechnology creates something called metamaterials. And these are materials that have properties that don't exist in the natural world in any bulk material we've seen.
All right, Sir Charles, hold it right there. In fact, we'll pick up on this when we get back. Sir Charles Schultz III is my guest. We're talking about nanotechnology, and this is well worth a listen. From Manila in the Philippines, where the rain is just coming down and coming down and coming down, I'm Art Bell.